and welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us. Seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking to mitigate reckless and destructive development, this program aims to increase your ecological intelligence, to encourage you to think globally, act locally, and to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Today my guests are Kevin Van Hardingsveld from McCallum Sather, Kevin Stelzer, principal with B+H Architects, and Tony Caputo, chief building and facilities officer at Mohawk College. The question for today is, can a building be designed to be net zero energy efficient?
A resounding yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all waiting to jump on that one. But
It can be done. The challenge has been there aren't that many examples out there. There are a few isolated ones, but certainly on any grand scale, there isn't really anything to compare to. So we're glad at Mohawk that we're the first to be out of the gate with this and looking forward to the experiences we'll have.
All right. Kevin from McCallum. There's a Kevin and a Kevin. So Kevin McCallum, what came first, the chicken or the egg? The building design, or was it the fact that there was going to be a building built and all the pieces were put together, and then the architects came along and said, well, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to change this and change that. What came first?
Well, I think the first point on this was the government grant, the Strategic Innovation Fund that became available, and then with a leader like Tony Caputo on the project, seeing the opportunity to set a standard, and if you're going to take something or you're managing a huge campus and you want to affect collectively, not just independent buildings. Tony's always been really strong on you get a building, you get a new construction building rather than a retrofit, take advantage. So I think that was kind of the first step.
Mm-hmm. The mandate came first.
Yeah, absolutely. We had the opportunity to set the bar very high through a proposal request for federal funds and through the Strategic Infrastructure Fund, and that worked. We were successful as a college. Receiving $20 million from the federal government to put up a new building. And through our application, we said we wanted to be leaders in the environment, leaders in sustainability, and we're setting the bar very high. We want a net zero building, and I think that helped sell the issue in terms of its innovation. It spoke to what we were trying to achieve with the building and the name. So we were able to get out of the gate very quickly. We even hired our consultants knowing that, and they had to know that we wanted that type of structure, net zero building. So when we hired the consultants and the contractor and even suppliers, so they had to know they were getting what they were getting into. And it's worked very well for us.
Okay, I'm going to ask Kevin Stelzer from B+H. How familiar were you with net energy efficiency, net zero?
Net zero energy. it is an evolving kind of an emergent idea in the built sector. I think the concept has been around for a long time. It really needs to be a pragmatic thing. So it has to be built, it has to be tested. So the idea has been around for a long time. We have done smaller buildings to a net zero energy standard, and we've done a whole bunch of studies, simulations, and that's why I would say that the Mohawk project is so thrilling to be involved in. It really mandates that the concept become real, become pragmatic. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, the idea's been around for a long time. We just need to invest in the process. We need to invest in the technologies. So that it's no longer something far fetched.
And Kevin from McCallum, tell us what a net zero building is.
So the first thing is a building that you're not going to need to over design the mechanical system to compensate for a poor envelope. So B+H, between the partnership of McCallum Sather and B+H took the lead on the envelope component, but setting that that envelope in a way that you're not overcompensating with the amount of heating and cooling that you're providing is the first step. net zero energy is what this building was defined under. We are exploring now, looking at the building being net zero carbon as well through a new program with the CAGBC. But net zero effectively is saying that the amount of energy that is consumed by the building is equal to the amount of energy that is produced by the building.
Renewably, so, yeah.
Yeah, and that can be defined in different ways. For this building, it's defined as over an annual period. So there will be points in the year where we are net positive and points in the year where we are net negative, but we are net zero after an annual analysis.
Contrary to what a lot of Canadians think, it's takes more energy to cool a building than heat a building. Is that true?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Very often, large institutional buildings require extensive cooling, so there's an idea that it takes more energy to cool a building. It's just generally a reflection of the size and scale of the building. But with respect to our building, it's going to take the same amount or the same power to heat the building or cool the building. It's just a function of how much heat comes in through the envelope or enclosure and how much leaves.
Okay, Tony, what is this building going to be used for?
Primarily, it'll be used for our Faculty of Engineering. So they'll be looking at partnerships and innovative classes and studies related to energy, related equipment, and state-of-the-art technologies that are emerging now in the engineering field. So that's the primary, quote, customer for the building. There are large lecture halls by our standards, and so we'll just pretty well everyone in the college will get a taste of at least visiting the building and being and participating in the building. One of the things we're looking at as well is trying to embrace the use of the building so that everyone is a little bit absorbed into the culture of what we're trying to propose with this building.
And what do you mean by that? Are the engineering students involved in the process or the day-to-day operation? Or?
Well, we tried our best to get them involved in some of the early design stages. It was a little bit complicated because of the time frame we had with this and just the time of year that we were really getting into it. But certainly from an operation perspective, we are anticipating that they'll be fully involved. We are suspecting and we're promoting the opportunity for students through different types of programs or studies that they can have groups that will be in charge of operating the building for a day or a week or a month or so and be graded on that. So the performance of the building will impact their academic results. It's something we have to work on, but it's very it's possible today with the technology that we can monitor not only the building, but we can monitor the performance of it, and we can monitor their performance of how well they're adapting to day-to-day changes in building environments.
So are we talking about turning the light off when you leave the room or something a bit more sophisticated than that?
It'd be more sophisticated than that. Actually, we have a number of systems within the building that'll manage the day-to-day things. The things that we grew up with, we don't have to worry about anymore. There's sensors that will turn lights off. There's sensors that'll turn ventilating systems off. There's the ability to manage and monitor plug loads. Things that are plugged into the building will understand better how they operate. It's the ability to to oversee the systems that will help manage that. That's the future of building sciences. There'll be systems, someday artificial intelligence, that will run buildings for us and make sure they adapt to the changes that are necessary. It depends on how many people are in the building, what time of day they're in, whether it's sunny or not, how much we're producing power through our photovoltaic systems. Students will be up to date with all that information and be able to adapt the building accordingly. We as a facilities department will help them, and it's a learning process, not only for us but for them, but that's how it'll work.
Yeah, I mean, the building was designed with a few mandates. The overarching net zero energy balance over the year was the primary one, but we don't have a crystal ball. We don't actually know exactly how the building will be occupied. So what we've tried to do is design systems that are demand operated. They only operate when the building requires it. So when there's enough light in the building, the lamps will turn off. If there's nobody in the building, the lights won't even operate. Also, our HVAC systems, our heating and cooling systems, we have a very advanced heat pump system. We have a ground source heat loop. We've drilled wells into the ground so we can tap into the heat from the earth, and we run what's called a variable refrigerant flow heat pump system. The idea here is that these systems can do a few things. They're all electric. The building is fully powered by electricity. And the idea is that we can monitor all the parts and all the components of the building. We know how everything operates, all the fans, all the heat pumps, all the compressors. The reason I'm saying this is that this system can actually move heat and cooling around the building. So if one part of the building is too hot, we can take, we can dump heat to other parts of the building that are too cool. The idea here is that as the building learns how to respond to its occupancy, the users can oversee that, and that's part of the learning. So after maybe a year of occupancy, can the building start to anticipate occupancy? We know that a large lecture is going to occur at a certain time and on a regular basis. Can that part of the building be pre-cooled in order to save energy? These are the things we'll learn. Right now we can't program that quite precisely, but at least the tools are there. Yes. So all that information can come flowing back so it can be understood, and then the building can be retro-commissioned so that it responds optimally to its occupancy.
Mm-hmm. So Kevin, you talked about the envelope, which is the outer skin, and how that's created so that it's efficient. There's photovoltaics, there's ground heat, ground source heat. Sounds like you've got everything going in this project.
It's a pretty efficient building.
And solar thermal as well. So we have solar thermal panels to help with preheating some of the water, not only for domestic use and within the building, but for some of these systems as well that will supplement the heats that needed to heat the building.
To give you just an example, if I might just interject, sorry, Tony, a typical office building in Canada uses about 335 equivalent kilowatt hours per square meter per year. That's an office building. It's not an engineering lab. It's not a high occupancy building like ours. Our building is simulated to use about 70. So this is an ultra-efficient building. And we had to start from that basis in order to develop enough power with our renewable energy sources to generate that net zero balance. So it's a very efficient building.
And why don't we do this for every building?
You know, that's a good question. I've been at this a little while, and here when I was working here at McMaster University, and I remember fondly some of the buildings we were getting involved in. And some of the first LEED buildings and institutions were right here at McMaster. There's a number of factors. Part of it, I think, is leadership. Part of it is just the ability to get another building going and another building up and operating without looking at the bigger picture. And I've been very fortunate to work with good institutions like McMaster and Mohawk, working with great consultants who have a common shared vision for a better future for buildings and facilities that will house particularly our students, but certainly general public or otherwise. And it's moving in the right direction. It's just taken 10, 15 years for people to see the light. And I think by demonstrating leadership, we've been able to move the bar higher and higher, and then others can see that it can easily be achieved. And I'll give an example. We had the first LEED Gold building of any institution in Ontario right here at McMaster, the Engineering Technology Building. LEED Gold today would be kind of a lower bar. Mm-hmm. But once we did that, other universities started doing it, other institutions started doing it, and now we're up to net zero. There's a number of net zero projects that are now either in the planning stage or just getting under construction. Mm-hmm. We're going to be fortunate to be the first in operation. So by doing that leadership and demonstrating that it can be done, that it can be done cost effectively, that it makes sense to do that, that students can be embraced in our case, as the major occupants of the building, people will see that and move forward. All of us, as institutions, as consultants, as the general public.
For me, it's really about culture. Mm-hmm. Everybody's under a lot of stress to be efficient, generate wealth, be careful with their money. All these things tend to pressure people into, well, I've done this before, I understand it, I'm going to do the same thing again. We also have this other competing cultural force of innovation, and innovation really likes to stir it up. You don't really know what the outcomes will be. But embracing innovation, embracing the process, to leading to something new is a cultural value. And I feel like the culture of the design and construction industry needs to change, because a lot of the things we do they're not necessarily capital expenses. Paying attention to air tightness in buildings where previously it just wasn't a concern, that's not a capital cost item. That's putting care and attention into the way you design and detail and the way that you construct.
And I would just add to that, why the original question, Lawson, you said, well, why doesn't this happen on every building? We've talked about LEED. Passive house is an example of a standard for tight enclosure, just natural passive design. There's a number of different things that can be done. Every building doesn't necessarily have to be to the same standard, but if we change that culture and everybody knows what can be done, then you can push on it. We talked about how this building has such a low energy use intensity at the low 70s of kilowatt hours per year per square meter. But this is a building where we have almost 2,000 modules of photovoltaics going up. Not everybody has the space to do that. There are other things that can be done, and this is totally achievable. This can be done and replicated on campuses across Canada and other typologies as well. But we all acknowledge that there's hurdles to get there. And if hurdles can't be overcome, every single hurdle on every single project, that doesn't mean you don't try. And that doesn't mean you don't set your standard higher.
Okay. Is it easier to build from the ground up or retrofit?
Well, I mean, I feel with the right culture, no, it's not. But there's a lot of learning we have to do with existing buildings. Mm-hmm. In the renovation sector that I think we are learning quickly.
Because mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that people are trying to grapple with. There's a heck of a lot of buildings already built.
Yes.
We're not going to knock them all down and just rebuild a net zero energy efficient building. So we have to learn to adapt to what is existing. Mm-hmm. What's the knowledge base out there on doing that? Are you guys doing that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. For sure. I mean, my colleague Kevin V., mentioned it earlier, there are various ways, and that's why I'm saying it's a bit of an emergent field, that kind of criteria and evaluation of high performance is changing, it's evolving. One of the things that we're starting to focus on, well, I should just backtrack. When we started on the Mohawk project, we said that in absence of any other standard for net zero energy performance, we're going to produce as much renewable energy as we're going to use on site. That was the standard we set. Now we're looking at other standards that I think are more holistic, which measure carbon. So what are the emissions that are produced through our building, which is really kind of the important thing. We're trying to preserve the atmosphere here. And so if we start looking at carbon, we can look at if we're using an electrified building and the production of electricity via, say, hydro is very clean, then we don't have to produce as much renewable energy on site. So we start focusing on the emissions. The reason I bring that up is that when we look at existing buildings, there's a lot of embodied carbon in the existing structure. Mm-hmm. So if we can save 25 or 30% of that embodied energy, we're already off to a good start. And if we can replace windows, put in a new enclosure, put in very high efficiency HVAC systems, there's a case to be made that that's a step forward. Mm-hmm. We have to wrestle with our existing stock in any case, because a lot of it's very poor performing. But I'm just saying that there is something to be said for retaining all that embodied carbon.
Right. Rather than knock it down and build a new. Because mm-hmm. for everything, whether it's cars or agriculture or everything else, to start from scratch, there is that, as you say, embedded carbon. It's not just a building. It's what did it take to get to that building? Right. How is the cement made? How is the
exactly.
Where did the wood come from? All those questions, and that's probably going to be the next generation of questions to be asked.
And that's what we're wrestling with, because we are a pilot project for the new CGBC mm-hmm. Zero Carbon Framework Net Zero Certification Program. We are submitting a embodied carbon life cycle assessment as part of that submission, so we can start building up a database that in the future buildings can start looking at embodied carbon as part of their carbon balance.
Right. Now, you threw an acronym out there.
Sorry.
I believe it's the Canada Green Building Council?
That's correct.
Okay. And I'm very pleased to announce that this group won the 2017 Innovation and Sustainability Award from that organization.
That's right, we did.
That was a proud night that we were there. It's something, I think it's testimony to the effort that was put in by our group and our team here to work closely with a leading organization that oversees the green buildings in Canada, and to be judged by your peers. Mm-hmm. And to win an award is an outstanding achievement that I think is helping support for everyone the clear notion that we're heading in the right direction, we're doing the right things, and that eventually for us and what we're doing as an institution, our students can learn from this ultimately. Why? Because we're leading by example.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was mentioned earlier about LEED, which I'm hoping all my listeners know what LEED is, but there are also other standards. There's BREEAM in the UK, Envision, the Institute for Sustainable Infrastructure, Green Globes, which is Canada and the US, Green Star, which is Australia, and of course, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, LEED. Is that a little confusing, or they've all got their own standards? Are we talking turf wars kind of thing, or
who wants to?
I can jump into that. There are other rating systems for buildings, just as there are for any other components in society. There are a number of groups. I think what's happened in the building world is that LEED, through the Green Building Councils, and namely the U.S. Green Building Council, which was kind of the catalyst that got this going in mid-90s, late 90s, and then here in Canada in the early 2000s. Most North Americans have gravitated to that system. But if you go to England, for example, they use BREEAM. That's their standard.
British Research Establishment, that's right.
Right, and I know I have colleagues in Ottawa, Carleton University, otherwise, they swear by Green Globes. They like that, it works for them. Mm-hmm. So what I would say is, there are some good systems out there, rating systems. Whatever, gravitate to one of them and make it work to the best of your ability. Mm-hmm. By far, typically, in North America, LEED has been the standard rating system for buildings that has gravitated to the top.
That's right. I mean, LEED's agenda was market transformation,
yes,
which is a different agenda than, for example, if you want to certify your building net zero energy. For example, the LEED system has you design your building against what would be considered a code building, and you measure your performance, or you simulate the performance of your building on an energy, from an energy perspective, against a virtual building, a building that's not going to get built. So you build a reference case. The LEED system has proven that that's effective. Buildings, when you actively simulate energy performance and try to reduce it, you end up reducing your energy consumption, but it's not a real empirical performance. Net zero energy, we need to actually measure the energy we consume and measure the energy we produce. Yeah, and that's what's going to make the certification happen. So there isn't a reference building that may or may not be built. It's not a virtual comparison. It's actually a real analysis. So it's a totally different type of system.
Okay, so measuring input and output kind of thing.
That's correct.
Is it too ambitious to ask for more energy coming from the building than being used?
No, we're not.
No, it's not. Actually, we suspect, certainly as Kevin mentioned earlier, Kevin V, that there will be times of year where that will be the case. We will produce more power than we'll consume. We're already working with the province on obtaining grants for battery storage. We want to take that surplus and actually store it for particular uses, either at the current time or other times of the day. So there's, I think as time goes on, there will be better systems in place that will help us take as much power in and use that at any time that we want. We'll do that at our homes. There'll be enough power to store to run virtually everything we need to do in the house. And then we can do that on a larger commercial institutional scale as well. That technology is coming. It's already here in a bit of a way, but trying to marry all that together for one singular project is difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Combination of a lot of factors, time,
right,
cost,
sure,
and everything else.
Yeah.
But I think we'll learn from that. As we've done what we're doing here, the next institution or next commercial environment will learn from that and say, okay, let's try this. Mm-hmm. Here's what they've done. We can optimize this part of it and do something a little differently or better. So it's happening.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit earlier. This kind of stuff just, you know, enthralls us, I think. We are working on a building, but I keep bringing up this idea of culture because what we really want is a total sort of society-wide positive influence. People need to learn. We need to work on projects. We need to learn. But ultimately, buildings work in combination in larger conurbations and urban environments. And, you know, a singular building that's net positive is certainly helpful, especially when they're large. But we really need, you know, large society-wide transformation. So we need to look at some buildings can produce more than they consume, and other buildings probably won't maybe meet that target. But when we look at them, you know, across regions or across districts, maybe we can get zero emission environments.
And just to add to that quickly, is one of the challenges with producing more power is you have to cooperate very well with your local distribution company. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that takes a little bit of paperwork and pre-engineering and agreements and a whole bunch of things. So
this is new for them, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, a little bit. You know, it that's right. They're going to have to adapt. If they don't adapt and make it conducive to undertake these types of projects, people will do it on their own. Mm-hmm. They'll find the battery storage and they'll do something else where the local utility will have a product that is used less and less over time by their customers because we've done something different. Mm-hmm. But we're working very closely with Electra, who's our group here, mm-hmm. and we're hoping to come to an agreement because they do have to, there's a safety factor in here they have to manage.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, when their utilities were initially conceived, it was a one-way supply.
Completely one-way.
Yeah, they produced the power and they distributed it to consumers. That was the model. I mean, now, you know, this two-way travel of electricity, it does take, you know, newer infrastructure mm-hmm. and a different way of looking at it. So it's an adjustment for everybody. We can't have the systems burning out because we're producing so much electricity pushing it the other way.
Yeah. Right. So there are a lot of different elements, a lot of different companies involved. Is this any more of a challenge than normal construction?
Oh, it's way more fun.
That's an interesting question.
He said with tongue in cheek.
I don't know. I like it. I love it.
It's more exciting because I think there's a different common mission and vision for these projects. You know, not only it's the owner and the consultants and others who are overseeing this, but we're looking even at the contractor level, like the individuals, the laborers, the electricians, for example, doing a lot of the wiring here. They need to better understand what the ultimate goal of the building is mm-hmm. and that the performance of what they're doing is a much more critical piece. It's more than just putting in the lights and the sensor. They want to make sure that everything's working correctly as opposed to maybe some of the older days where productivity was just the issue of just getting in, installing stuff and getting out. Mm-hmm. They know they need to leave with systems working the way that they were intended to be installed 100%. If it doesn't happen that way, it's a challenge. So we're actually working with, we're hoping to be working very closely with the provincial government on some studies and research on the ability of helping to train labor to make sure that they're ready for the next wave of zero carbon buildings, net zero buildings, so that they better understand in terms of their overall knowledge of how these systems work. Mm-hmm. So, and that's something that was a little different than what was in the past. It wasn't that wasn't the key issue for them.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. But if people want to find out more, where can they go to?
Any one of us, of course.
Give us some websites.
Well, Mohawk
has a great website. You can get on our Mohawk College website. There's a direct link to our Net Zero Mohawk link that will get you embraced into the building, and there's lots of contact information from there. And my email address is there as well, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that people have. It's an exciting time.
All right. Kevin and Tony, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.